From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a new kid show that's strictly for adults. We talk with Robert Smigel about his new series on Comedy Central TV Funhouse. The host of the show is a cheerful young man named Doug. His Funhouse pals are a group of grumpy and lecherous animal puppets. Smigel also created the puppet Triumph the Insult comic dog for Late Night with Conan O'Brien. Smigel created several cartoon series for Saturday Night Live, including the ambiguously gay duo and ex-presidents. Also, critic Milo Miles reviews the new edition of The Rough Guide to World Music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect George W. Bush met today with the man he defeated and the man he's hoping to replace, NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Bush met Al Gore at the vice president's mansion. That's the Hilltop residence in Washington where Gore waited out his long battle with Bush over Florida's electoral votes. The two men said little to reporters waiting outside in the snow and met inside for only about 15 minutes. Earlier, Bush met with the man who many Republicans had considered the real opponent all along. He posed for pictures with President Bill Clinton at the White House. The president relaxed in his chair as the president-elect sat stiffly beside him.
It's such a huge honor to come as the president-elect, and I don't think I really fully realize the impact until I swear in.
The day before, George W. Bush had warned of a possible economic slowdown. President Clinton said Bush would have economic challenges and told reporters you ought to give him a chance to meet them, not try to figure it all out in advance. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
The Federal Reserve has decided not to change short-term interest rates, at least for the time being. The decision means that the federal funds rate will stay at 6.5%. That's the highest it's been in 9 years. The federal funds rate is the interest that banks charge each other on overnight loans. The Federal Reserve policymakers also changed their policy directive, a statement that reflects how they're thinking about the economy. The directive said the Fed no longer sees inflation as the main threat to the economy. Instead, it said that economic weakness is now the biggest threat. That suggests that the Fed could be prepared to cut interest rates if the economy shows signs of slowing even more. Officials of Bridgestone, Firestone, and the Ford Motor Company say design and manufacturing defects are responsible for tread separation problems that have forced the recall of millions of tires. Quinn Kleinfelter reports from member station WDET in Detroit.
In separate interviews with federal investigators, Bridgestone and Ford officials said that treads peel away from some 15-inch Wilderness and ATX Firestones because of a poorly designed layer of rubber wedged between the tires' steel belts. That layer of rubber is only half as thick as that used in 16-inch tires. Bridgestone officials also say procedures at Firestone's Decatur, Illinois plant call for mixing more lubricants into tire rubber than typical, which could reduce the ability of a tire to stick together. Ford officials say those factors make the recalled tires particularly prone to fail at high speeds or in hot climates. In August, Firestone recalled about 6.5 million tires because of tread separation problems linked to almost 150 fatal accidents. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 61 points to close at 10,584 in heavy trading. This is NPR News from Washington. New York's mayor and city council members are initiating legislation to stop people from driving while using a cell phone. Marianne McCune reports from member station WNYC.
New York's mayor and city council say it's time to rein in the talkers, fine them from $50 to $150 for holding phone to ear while navigating the city streets. Officials point to a study showing people who drive and talk on the phone are 4 times more likely to crash. But the proposed bill only punishes those holding their phones in hand. Councilmember Noak Deer says requiring an attachable earpiece is hardly an imposition.
Today, the contraptions are so many. That it's so cheap, it's not even funny that there's no reason why you should not use it.
Several nearby counties have already introduced such a ban, but mass transit advocates wish New York would go further with an outright ban on driving and phone talking. They say studies show the danger is in the distraction, not having only one hand on the wheel. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McCune in New York City.
A jury in Montgomery, Alabama, found today that ExxonMobil Corporation should pay $3.5 billion to the state of Alabama. The jury said the oil company cheated Alabama out of royalties from natural gas wells in state waters. The award came to about $88 million in compensatory damages, with the rest as punishment for ExxonMobil's actions. A spokesman said the giant oil company will appeal the verdict. Prosecutors showed the jury internal company documents saying that Alabama officials were inexperienced and that the company could get away with underpaying. ExxonMobil said the problem was a simple contract dispute rather than fraud. In stocks today, the NASDAQ lost 113 points or 4.3%. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Robert Smigel, is the creator of several cartoons that are featured on Saturday Night Live, The Ambiguously Gay Duo, The Ex-Presidents, and Fun with Real Audio. He also created the puppet Triumph the Insult Comic Dog for Late Night with Conan O'Brien. Smigel does the voice of Triumph, as well as the voices of President Clinton, Al Gore, and others in Conan's Clutch Cargo sketches. Smigel was the first head writer of the show. Now he's co-created a show on Comedy Central called TV Funhouse. It's a parody of Kid Show, but it's strictly for adults. The host, Doug, is played by comic Doug Dale. His friends on the show are an assortment of animal puppets called the Annapals. Each week, Doug has an idea for a themed show, like a cowboy show, a Hawaiian show, or a Christmas show. But the Annapals are always too grumpy and lecherous to have any interest in Doug's ideas. Here's the opening of the first episode with Doug and his animal friends. Doug is dressed in a cowboy outfit and a 10-gallon hat.
Partners, welcome to Western Day here on TV Funhouse. We're gonna behave like wild Westerners. Hey, let's go give the Annapals their cowboy outfits. Howdy do, Annapals. Y'all set for Western Day?
Hey, Doug.
What's up?
Nothing. I just reckon it's high time you varmints put on these cowboy hats.
Maybe later.
Yeah, not in the mood, Doug.
Varmints?
I got my cowboy hat on.
Great. Why don't you shove it up your ass?
Whoa, that was harsh.
Can we get the hell out of here, please?
Doug, I apologize. Listen, Chicky's wife's on the rag again.
Robert Smigel, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Outside of Doug, who's the human host of TV Funhouse, the characters are all animals. Why are there so many animals in it?
That really was a spinoff of what I do on Conan with Triumph, the insult comic dog. This dog who started out as a vehicle with which to proverbially poop on guests like John Tesh and David Hasselhoff, who come out and are just begging for it. And then evolved into a puppet that interacts with live animals in various ways. Most, by various, I mean lewd. and generally lewd. And he became very popular in Comedy Central. I was looking for an interstitial segment with which to, in between cartoons and short films. And this is what we came up with. Dino Stamatopoulos and I had sort of developed this menagerie. This crass menagerie, as TV Guide called it.
Let's talk a little bit about the animals who you have.
Okay.
One of my favorites is this mangy dog is always chasing his tail.
Yeah, that's my favorite. That's my favorite character, actually. He is based on a real dog. His name is Zabu, and that was the real dog's name. And I even made the puppet look exactly like the dog. It was my wife's. It was my wife's dog. He was a German Shepherd mix. And I believe part wolf, and they took him to obedience school, and after two sessions, the teacher said, you know what, he's a beautiful dog, and you should just enjoy him. He's beautiful. Take him home. He was that stupid. And one of the reasons my wife and I get along so well is because we can both laugh for a half hour just watching a dog that stupid chase his tail, which is what we used to do. The dog had this incredibly incredible rage, it seemed, toward his tail. And there's just there are few things funnier than watching a really dumb animal passionately go after his tail. And then he had this way of chasing it, and I guess I've seen this with other dogs, but not to this effect, where he could go 90 miles an hour in a circle and then just stop on a dime and completely freeze and then go 90 miles back on a dime, just like as if he was trying to. He didn't look like he was catching his breath. He actually looked like he thought he would trick his tail this way. You know, I'll turn and turn and turn and then stop. And the tail will have no idea what's going on. He'll be totally frozen, you know. And then, boom, I'm back at the tail. But it just, of course, it never worked.
So that's your voice that the dog does? I mean,
yeah, yeah. I'm basically, I have this stubborn insistence on making all the dogs sound like Eastern European immigrants. You know, and I've noticed that some people have criticized, you know, they've watched the show and they've said, why do all the dogs sound like Triumph, you know? Why do they have the same accent? It's like, it's lame. Can't he come up with another voice? And, well, yeah, I could, you know, I realize there are more accents in the world than Eastern European, but in my head, that's how dogs talk. They just, they have for years. Since I was 10 years old, I used to, you know, give dogs that voice when I would look at dogs. I think it's because my grandparents they're Russian immigrants, and I grew up with that voice. I grew up with that voice in my family for years, and I think I make an unconscious connection. And let me finish the thought because it could sound rude, but between dogs and immigrants just off the boat, because they both have a certain element of wide-eyed wonder that, as if to say, like, oh, look at all of this, I cannot believe this. And you know, eventually European immigrants catch up and become jaded, but dogs never do, and that's why I can laugh at dogs forever.
The dog that chases its tail, it's kind of like a Roadrunner cartoon where the dog is Roadrunner, yeah, and his tail is Wile E. Coyote or vice versa.
No, the dog is Wile E. Coyote. It's absolutely an homage, you know, beyond the initial idea. Yeah, in the first episode, the dog buys products from the Acme Corporation. And in the first episode, he buys a tail catcher. And, you know, it's meant to deceive the tail. There's a little hole, and it says, tail massager. Come on over here, tail. Look at this. Tail massager. Wow, it's for 12-inch tails, just like you. And then in a later episode, he actually dresses up as a tail to seduce the tail. So you see a giant tail attached to the tiny little tail, and Zabu's face is just sticking out. Hey, taily boy, come on over here. And later, in future episodes, I want Zabu to just become just impassioned and obsessed with, you know, making everyone in on, like, it's as if it's a Kennedy conspiracy thing where he's got photographs to prove that the tail is, you know, is a criminal, and he hires a detective to go after the tail.
There's also a very lecherous chicken.
Well, a lot of the animals are lecherous.
That's true, they're all lecherous, yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to, you know, delineate the characters somehow and take the lechery out of some of the show. In the pilot episode, a lot of them go to a Tijuana whorehouse and basically trade off on a pair of live chihuahuas. But, you know, so the chicken is a very neurotic character. He's a rooster, actually. He's a rooster, and he's the most high-strung character whose personality just lends him to confrontation more than any of the others. The guys go off to Mexico, and Chicky's instinct is to just, you know, he has a drink or two in him, and he just wants to bust heads, and he catches sight of a cockfight, And so he goes in and challenges a live rooster. So you get that, you get puppet versus animal violence as well as puppet versus animal sex. There's a lot more to the show than puppets having sex with live animals. There's also puppets fighting live animals. The rooster didn't really fight the chick, the puppet, excuse me. We faked it.
There are real animals mixed in with the puppets. The puppets are driving a car, and there's a real dog in the car, too. Or the puppets are at a cockfight, and in the audience, there's a real dog.
That's right.
Or there's a puppet cat who gives birth to real kittens.
Live kittens. Mm-hmm.
What's the interest to you of mixing real animals with puppet animals?
I love the idea that that you can manipulate live animals into a really funny bit, and they have no idea why it's funny, why they're there. That just adds a layer of joy to the whole experience to me. And, we make it very clear, and we make a real point of not making the animals actually do anything. Like in the cockfight, for example, there's a bunch of animals in the audience. But if you look in the background, a lot of them are asleep, even though we have cheering noises. A lot of them are just lying down, have no interest in what's going on. And like on the one hand, there's like a practical joke element to it that we're playing on the live animals, that we're making them appear to be doing things. But on the other hand, I also enjoy the joke the animals are having on the show by expressing no interest in what's going on, even though we're presumably trying to make them appear to be extras. They're above it. They have better things to think about than pretending to enjoy a cockfight.
My guest is Robert Smigel. He co-created the Comedy Central series TV Funhouse. It's a parody of kid shows, but it's strictly for adults. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Smigel, and he's the creator and co-executive producer of the new Comedy Channel series TV Funhouse. He's also the creator of some of the cartoons on Saturday Night Live, including the Ambiguously Gay Duo and Ex-Presidents. There's, by the way, also a new Ex-Presidents comic book.
Yes.
One of the things I think you're doing on TV Funhouse with all your use of the Annapals, puppet animals, is having them do the kind of things that animals really do in public, but that people only do behind closed doors, such as having sex, defecating. I know, like, as a kid, there's things you learn that people don't do in front of other people, period.
Right.
But you see animals doing it all the time in the street.
That's right.
And it's very confusing sometimes as a kid. Like, how come they let animals do that in the street?
Yeah. I know. We can learn a lot from animals.
well, that's the whole point of the books that your parents give you, so you can learn a lot from animals.
Right. And now this is an adult show that's trying to have animals teach people how to behave properly. No, there is something, it's fun doing a show with that has characters that don't have the inhibitions that humans do and that can talk casually about things like pooping on the street or having sex as if it's just a regular animal need, I try to explain to people that when I write about sex or I write about defecation, I'm going to look like an idiot saying this, trying to explain why I think this stuff is funny beyond,
cheap, crude laughs.
Cheap laughs.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it's all about the way our dignity is compromised. Sex has always cracked me up because it makes people do crazy things, like working out. I mean, Jesus. Can you imagine? Anyway, but it, that's the funniest thing about it, that we are You know, I remember years ago, we were at Saturday Night Live and I was hanging out with Conan O'Brien, who I met there as a writer, and Rob Lowe was hosting. And so everybody was passing around the Rob Lowe sex tape, and it was just, you know, something that you don't get to see that often, is just a real life porn like that. And, you know, just a lot of it was really boring. And, but all this fuss was being made over something that was, you know, quite common. And I don't know, it was just, I just remember Conan just laughing and just saying, we're just all animals. It's hilarious. And so, and that really is the heart of it. You know, so to write about characters and have them just casually debate, oh, come on, are you crazy? Licking is much better than sniffing. You're out of your mind. Well, what about vomiting? Well, vomiting's good, but, you know, it's not the same.
Did you have a lot of pets when you were a kid?
I had a cat when I was 4 years old. My parents gave me a cat, and the cat just sat on the foot of my bed and did nothing all day long, just grew, sort of developed that mashed potato body that cats get, just sort of spread on the carpet as the years went by. But I just adored it. It had no interest in anything, but I just like, pretty kitty. Good. I just loved it. Loved it like nothing else. And then later on, after the cat died, my sister, who didn't really like the cat, suddenly... This is I've noticed this too, that like it's the sibling who didn't like the animal that suddenly is like gets all emotional about the animal when it dies and wants to replace it immediately. And that's what happened. And then we got a little tiny Bichon, all I could do all day was talk to the Bichon in its own voice. And it was very similar to Triumph's voice, just a higher pitch, you know, because it was such a froofy little thing. And it was just very spoiled. I want to eat now, please.
Did you talk to it a lot?
I used to drive my sister crazy. Just, you know, she would like walk into the room and I would say hi and the dog would run up to her and I would be like, hello, hello, I've waited all day for you. Where the hell have you been?
Did you have puppets as a kid?
No, I didn't have puppets. I used to draw cartoons, though. I was a crazed cartoon. I worshipped Charles Schulz, and and I wanted to be a cartoonist when I was like, you know, 6 years old. But you know, over time, you just lose confidence and interest in pursuing a career in anything but what your father does. At least that's what happened for me. I never thought I could make a living doing anything creative.
And your father was a dentist.
Sort of backed in. My father is a dentist. He's a very successful dentist. And I went to dental school. I applied to dental school and went through a whole agonizing pre-dental program. And I just knew that I couldn't handle it all the way through. But I just didn't believe that I could really do anything else that would be as... I felt like he has a very good practice, and this is a great opportunity, and who am I to not take advantage of this? So I went through the process, but I fortunately, like, failed organic chemistry at the and so I actually was rejected and had to look for something else to do.
There are some very funny cartoons on TV Funhouse. I want you to describe the premise of Wonder Man.
Wonder Man is a classic superhero who has an alter ego. His name is Henry Moore. And basically, we follow the adventures of Wonder Man trying to help his alias have sex with women who are impressed with Wonder Man. Because Wonder Man, of course, has to maintain the... you know, I'm married to crime-fighting attitude. But at the same time, he needs to have sex. And I never understood why Superman didn't use this technique for Clark Kent. It would have been so simple for him to just explain to Lois Lane that Clark Kent's really cool. And then he could have had it just both ways.
Well, in Wonder Man and in your animation, The Ambiguously Gay Duo, you seem to really know that sex is the subtext of so much pop culture, even the stuff for kids. Like even the superhero stuff, the way they're dressed, a lot of their feats of strength, a lot of the kind of rescuing, which is almost like S&M imagery. So, right? Some of it, so much of it is about sex.
I guess so. That's another new one for me. I'm amazed how, I seem to write a lot about sex, but I'm always surprised by what people read into stuff. And then when I think about it, it's usually true. Like even with The Ambiguously Gay Duo, it's based on something that never really occurred to me for years, which was this homoeroticism of the Batman and Robin cartoon. I remember doing a Superman special, the 50th anniversary that Lorne Michaels had, been asked to produce. And I remember Lorne Michaels telling me, oh, well, of course, Batman and Robin have that underlying gay thing. And I just sort of played along like, oh, yeah, right, right. But my heart was broken. What? What are you talking about? I don't know. I was 26 years old and I just, why does there have to be sex in Batman and Robin? They're, and years later, those movies started getting gayer and gayer and they started sprouting nipples and, there'd be tight shots of their rear ends and their crotchetal areas. And, by now I understood what they were going for, but my feeling was, why can't we just leave Batman and Robin alone? They do good work. Just let them do their thing. We don't have to speculate on what they do is their business, whether it's with each other or, Kim Basinger. It just doesn't matter. And so that's where that cartoon came from. But then the irony was that I thought gay people would love the cartoon for that reason. Like, yes, you're right. People are obsessed with sexuality. Why can't they just let things be? But it turns out, like, every gay friend I have loves that cartoon because they watch the imagery and they're like, ha ha, yeah, of course they're gay. That's right. They're gay. You nailed them. They're just as obsessed with sexuality as everyone else.
Robert Smigel co-created the new Comedy Central series TV Funhouse. It's shown Wednesdays at 10:30 and is repeated Fridays at 1 a.m. and Sundays at 11:30 p.m. Smigel will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, will Bill Clinton join the four ex-presidents who were endowed with superpowers after being struck by radioactive lightning at a celebrity golf tournament? We continue our talk with Robert Smigel. His cartoon series, Ex-Presidents, is featured on Saturday Night Live. And Milo Miles reviews the new edition of The Rough Guide to World Music. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Smigel. He co-created the new show TV Funhouse on Comedy Central. It's a lewd parody of kid shows, and it's strictly for adults. He also created the puppet Triumph the Insult Comic Dog for Late Night with Conan O'Brien, and he created several animated series for Saturday Night Live, including the ambiguously gay duo and the Ex-Presidents. He has a new Ex-Presidents comic book. Now, there's an Ex-Presidents cartoon that has just been published, so let's talk a little bit about Ex-Presidents.
Yeah.
The premise of this is that the four Ex-Presidents, Ford, Reagan, Carter, and Bush, have been struck by hurricane-powered radioactive lightning, which gave at a celebrity golf tournament, which gave them extraordinary superpowers. And they use these superpowers to save people from Earthlings and from aliens. Let's hear a short clip from Ex-Presidents in which the Ex-Presidents are using those extraordinary superpowers.
The Ex-Presidents!
Read my lips. You're toast. There you go again.
Robots, intercept! Quickly!
I have lost it in my heart to kick your ass. There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe.
You stupid Earthling, you shall pay for this blunder.
Have you heard from any of the Ex-Presidents who you've included in in this sketch?
Gerald Ford wants a better catchphrase. He's like, but the poor guy, that's all he can ever come up with. The other ones have, they've got such catchy ones, and all he can say is, there is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe. No, none of them have ever bothered to call. And I'm very surprised and disappointed that they have better things to do than talk to me. The only thing I've ever heard is that Gerald Ford was asked about it, and he said he's asleep way before that show ever comes on the air, which I believe.
No,
I'm very grateful that they're all still alive, frankly.
Will Bill Clinton soon be included as an ex-president?
He'll be trying. He'll be trying to be included, but he wasn't at the golf tournament. We might do an ex-presidents in January where Bill Clinton tries to join. The great thing about him is that he would have a great... the ones that have catchphrases are the easiest to write for, and Bill Clinton has a number of great catchphrases that would make good Clint Eastwood kick-ass things, like, you know, you punk, you're going to feel my pain. or he'd say, I'm going to build a bridge to... Well, they're all going to sound too filthy on NPR.
Right.
I'm sorry. But, and George W., if he ever becomes an ex-president, he's, you know, I think his whole candidacy was built on catchphrases. So, you know, uniting, dividing, I mean, there's a lot you can do with him someday.
Now, among the things that you've done, you do some of the Clutch Cargo writing and some of the voices as well, I think. You do the voices,
yeah,
too, on
I do
Conan
most
O'Brien.
Of the yeah, I don't do a lot of the writing anymore. You know, I did when I started the show with Conan and the other writers, but I just go on there, you know, to do these voices generally, and which is a lot of fun to be a performer instead of a writer and be able to walk in and critique other people's writing for a change, you know.
What were some of your favorite Clutch Cargo sketches during the election aftermath?
Oh, God.
There was a funny Gore one where he's talking about how he's getting very overexcited.
Yeah, well, he does that a lot on the show. This is terribly exciting. This entire event has been... an absolute thrill. Well, at the very end, like after he finally conceded, he gave a very sarcastic, hasn't this just been a terribly exciting and informative experience? The American public has, the wheels of democracy have worked once again, and the American people have gotten their wish. All 49% of them, they have spoken. And we've learned all kinds of great things, like the winner does not necessarily get to go into the office. And we've learned great words like fiasco, and we've all learned how to despise the elderly. And it was that kind of thing.
How did you get Gore's voice? That's pretty good.
Thank you very much. I would watch him, and I'd actually talked to Dana Carvey about it, because he was trying to work on a Gore and a Bush and that kind of thing. And one thing he said was that a lot of us noticed that he has a little bit of a lisp. We don't know where it comes from, but he has a tiny lisp that sounds a little fey. And Dana described him as like a gay Forrest Gump. That's where his impression came from. But that actually helped me subconsciously. Dana has this way of like creating a rebus sort of school of coming up with impressions. Like he says that George Bush is John Wayne combined with Mr. Rogers. Somehow it combines into not gonna do it. It's like a gentle John Wayne or something.
When you're doing political satire, do you want to be what some comics describe as a, quote, equal opportunity offender? Or do you really want to go with your political point of view and basically, through your humor, make a point about where you stand and what you think?
Throughout this election, I thought it was, I think the closer elections, I noticed that the writers get more partisan and more passionate about imposing their point of view on the audience. And I don't think the audience really wants that from comedians. You know, maybe from certain kinds of, people who present themselves that way, and that's their act, like someone like Al Franken, who everybody likes, despite the fact that he's clearly one way, because he just doesn't make any bones about it. Well, I don't know. Everybody likes him, I'm sure. He has enemies, but a sketch show like Saturday Night Live or Conan, I really think the audience doesn't want to feel like they're being manipulated. It was odd because during this campaign, I noticed that there was a lot of tension at Saturday Night Live, more than I'd probably ever seen throughout a presidential election. Things always heat up when there's an election, but this time there were like two factions that seemed to be at odds with each other.
What were they?
Generally, the show, when I was a staff writer there years ago, it was Al Franken and Jim Downey who were kind of in charge of the political stuff. You know, I would occasionally write something very silly that would somehow get on. You know, but my takes were usually really silly ideas, like Ronald Reagan is the genius behind the whole, there was during the Iran-Contra scandal when it was all about what did the president know and what didn't he know. I had this idea for a sketch where Reagan was just the genius behind everything, because I was sick of Reagan as idiot sketches. And then later on, there was like a Ross Perot that I snuck in somehow, where he's like driving in a car with Admiral Stockdale after the debate, and he like dumps him in the middle of a field and takes off, and sort of more sillier premises. But Downey and Franken were the guys who really wrote, the sort of think pieces all through those years, and they were balanced because one was more left of center and one more right of center, and they were very careful to be even-handed. But in their absence, I think the show has swung far more to the left, And even though I was an avid Gore supporter, and I would probably classify myself as a liberal, I didn't enjoy seeing heavy-handed stuff rammed down my throat. And I don't think it really, I don't think that's what SNL or sketch shows are for, but then during the election there was like a faction of writers who were actually vehemently for Bush, and you would see these weird like pieces on the show that suddenly out of nowhere, they were like attack pieces on Al Gore. And some of them were funny and some of them weren't. And it just, it was all born out of this, you know, determination on both sides to, you know, affect the election. I just hope that the next election isn't that close, because it has a bad effect on comedy. Just, you know, that's not what people want to see. Even though Saturday Night Live had a very good run with these two guys, I mean, they're both hilarious performers, Daryl Hammond and Will Ferrell, you know. It got kind of ugly sometimes.
So were there like political fights backstage, behind the scenes, in the writing rooms?
Well, you know, as much as, you know, people are pretty busy over there just trying to get 90 minutes of television on the air. But, you know, yeah, there was some tension between writers from what I could, you know, I basically show up and, you know, with my animal bestiality cartoon or something. Huh? Hi, guys. How's it going? Yeah, I'm doing Sex in the Country this week.
That what? Was a funny
Political?
One. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm glad you liked it. Well, a lot of people were, like, horrified by it. You have to know the show.
Right.
That was one time where the sex stuff, you know, really angered people.
My guest is Robert Smigel. He created the Saturday Night Live animations, The Ambiguously Gay Duo, and Ex-Presidents. He has a new Ex-Presidents comic book. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Smigel. He co-created TV Funhouse, a new show on Comedy Central that's a lewd parody of kid shows and is strictly for adults. Some of the episodes of TV Funhouse have these parodies of those old 1950s personal hygiene films where, you know, yeah. you're taught, like, how to behave at dinner, how to behave in class, right. how to go on your first right. date.
Right.
And you're discouraged from doing anything sexual alone or with others. I have an excerpt here of one of your personal hygiene film or educational okay. training film parodies. And this is about mnemonic devices. And mnemonic oh, okay. devices are those little word games you can make up to help you memorize something you're supposed to memorize. So let's hear this excerpt.
Memorization. It's the hardest part of school, and probably life. But remembering facts can be easy and fun, too, with a little help from something called mnemonics. You probably used a mnemonic without knowing it. For example, to remember the notes for reading music, you might use the mnemonic, "Every good boy deserves fudge." Starting to get it? It's fairly easy to remember our friends north, south, east, and west. But in case you're having trouble, all you have to think of is, "No Spaniard enjoys washing." Easy, isn't it? Biology is nothing but tedious memorization. But mnemonics can make it easy. The complicated order of animal classification, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, are easier to remember as, "Please come over for gay sex." Now you'll never forget it. Look out, biology.
That's really so funny, and I wish our listeners could actually see the film, because it looks like the real thing. It's shot in black and white. Everybody looks very 1950s. There are puzzled students scratching their head in biology class. Did you sit through these films when you were in school, or were you past the era of these movies?
I was a little bit past that era, you know, but I have... I love anything that's, you know... I'm one of those people who loves kitsch and things that are rooted in innocence. So, you know, yeah, I grew up more in the 70s, but you know, even back then you would see these things rerun and you were aware of them. So I still get a kick out of that stuff. And mnemonic devices specifically are something that I became intimately familiar with in college, and I just found them contemptible because they basically encapsulated what I hated about being a pre-med student or pre-dental student, which was that, you know, I would take these courses like, you know, organic chemistry that had nothing, and the approach to teaching them had nothing to do with education. It had everything to do with weeding out the best students, and so it used to drive me crazy.
Now, you actually have a kid who's, I think, around two.
Yeah.
Are you worried that he will end up at a young age seeing some of your adult versions of kid shows?
Well, I've talked to Dana Carvey about that kind of thing because, you know, he has kids. They're about 6 and 8. And he just, he said he was very good at shielding them from everything that he did for years and years. You know, you have a lot of control over what your kid sees if you choose to. And so that's what I intend to do, is protect him from me as best I can. And then by the time he's 8, this kind of thing is exactly what he's going to be interested in, you know, seeing despite his parents' wishes. So maybe it'll be more effective that I'm the source of the, you know, if I'm the one telling him, no, this isn't right for you, and I'm like the source of what he's trying to see, it might even, you know, hopefully it'll be more effective.
My guest is Robert Smigel. He's the creator of the new Comedy Central show, TV Funhouse, which is an adult version, a very adult version of a kid's show. Now, I want to ask you about Triumph, the insult comic dog, which you've done on Conan. Now, the really funny thing, as I'm sure our audience knows, mm-hmm. is that Pets.com came up with a sock puppet dog, and Triumph made fun of the Pets.com dog. Then Pets.com sued Triumph, which I guess means suing you. And so here you are, you've done like ex-presidents and stuff, and you don't even hear from the ex-presidents, but your lawsuit came from two puppets having their go at each other.
Yeah, well, in fairness, I sort of initiated that confrontation to some degree because I was disturbed by those commercials. I wasn't initially disturbed. I noticed them, and they were very similar to something I had done on Conan, you know, about 6 months earlier, where Triumph went to Westminster and was interacting with dogs. And it didn't really bother me, but then a lot of people from the Conan show started asking me about it, and it bothered a lot of people at the show. And then the commercials became more and more popular, and people were like, I would go to the show to do Triumph or to do the lips bit, and it was a constant, it became like a cacophony of, we should sue, what's going on, this is crazy, you know? And there was this issue of concern that the Pets.com thing was at the Super Bowl, you know, I mean, they were spending all this money on commercials and in much higher visibility places than late night television, and there was a concern that people would start to think that Triumph was ripping off the Pets.com puppets. So, you know, I sent a letter to Pets.com that, you know, expressed, you know, I had some lawyer do it, and I don't even remember exactly how the letter was written, but this guy wrote a letter for me, you know, and I didn't threaten, I didn't sue or anything, but, you know, it was one of those, you know, serious legal letters. And that was really, and then they sort of responded in an amicable way. But in the interim, like, people were beginning to notice that the dog was a ripoff, and the Jon Stewart show actually invited Triumph on the Daily Show to make fun of the Pets.com sock puppet. So I couldn't resist the offer. And then it turned into a defamation lawsuit because this puppet had criticized this other puppet.
Your puppet Triumph criticized the Pets.com puppet.
Yeah, you know.
So how did the lawsuit end?
I don't think it is. I don't know what's happened. I mean, Pets.com dissolved in all this. I sort of handed it over to NBC very quickly, and I really didn't want to think about it, and I didn't talk to the press about it when it all came out because to me, it wasn't interesting publicity to be this guy in the middle of a lawsuit. It didn't have a lot of charm for me to, you know, to suddenly look like Pat Cooper or something. I'm mad about this. He's ripping me off, you know. I mean, that's what I was doing on the Jon Stewart show, was like turning Triumph into Pat Cooper. Triumph went on the Jon Stewart show and he was like, everyone rips off Triumph. You know, it's not just the sock puppet, that Kermit the Frog ripped me off. And then we like showed a doctor's photo of Kermit and, you know, Howdy Doody ripped me off. And they showed a puppet, a Howdy Doody puppet having sex with a live dog. And even Harry Connick Jr., you know, and then there's a picture of Harry Connick Jr. with a dog. He called it an homage, but, you know, that's what he always says. I was just kidding around, you know, for that thing. But that's when, you know, they sued me, and I don't know. I thought it was some sort of intimidation lawsuit, since I was just a comedy writer. But then NBC got involved, you know, because it's basically their character, and that was really the end of the lawsuit. I mean, I don't think they really pursued it with the same vigor once NBC was involved, and the thing kind of petered out, just like the company, I guess.
Well, Robert Smigel, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Robert Smigel co-created the new Comedy Central series TV Funhouse. It's shown Wednesdays at 10:30 and is repeated Fridays at 1 a.m. and Sundays at 11:30 p.m. Smigel also has a new ex-president's comic book. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews The Rough Guide to World Music. This is Fresh Air. Together a book that covers all aspects of any kind of music is daunting. The many authors of The Rough Guide to World Music have tried to get a grip on all the music outside of Western classical. Why? Because it's there. Music critic Milo Miles has a review.
Assembling a comprehensive encyclopedia of world music is like trying to dig through a steel wall with a toothpick. It's an insane task, bound to fall short and drive everybody involved crazy. But with international media more developed than ever, it's a job that actually seems doable these days. The first edition of The Rough Guide to World Music was promising, but felt rushed and fragmentary. It would be perverse to resist the new two-volume edition, however. This is a very soccer fanatic, Encyclopedia Britannica type undertaking. The first volume covers Africa, Europe, and the Middle East. The second does Latin and North America, the Caribbean, India, Asia, and the Pacific. The Rough Guide, of course, touches on countries from Uzbekistan to Melanesia and includes record guides for each. But it also profiles a smart selection of key performers, often with interviews, and it gets down nice details like the history of instruments, record stores around the world and on the internet, and lists of annual music festivals. Plus, you can find out tidbits, like why Romanians distrust folk music. The Rough Guide to World Music provides more than 1,400 pages of information that is just clearer and more useful than the competition. If you are interested in the music of just one foreign country, this book is the recommended way to branch out. There are problems. The Rough Guide to World Music is simply not a transcendent work in itself. If you have more than 100 contributors with 100 points of view, you have essentially no viewpoint. A single guiding sensibility, no matter how much it leaves out, can become a companion in a way that a collective study guide cannot. You never know what assumptions will underpin a country's description. Sometimes rock-related performers are included, sometimes not. Sometimes you get the rough guide to the Britney Spears and Backstreet Boys of the world. Also, the sheer overwhelmingness of it all might be reduced if classical and folk traditions were in separate volumes. And finally, the book shows a peculiar fixation with geography, no doubt related to its roots as a tourist helper. For example, the pop dance style known as Bhangra began in England and is still based there, but it is clearly an offshoot of Indian, not British, music. So why put the main discussion in a section with England? Likewise, the group Zap Mama may live in Belgium, but few who know their Pan-African style would look for them under Belgium. So if you're looking to buy albums instead of plane tickets, the guide can be confusing. Speaking of albums, the Rough Guide does a decent job with the conflict between best ever and best available. How can I complain that the authors don't mention enough out-of-print classics when they've already directed me to exciting new albums from Australia, India, and Greece, places I needed help? Hey, the Rough Guide to World Music may be a tour bus between covers, but it will get you where you need to go.
Milo Miles is a writer based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Dial Press, publisher of Letters of the Century, edited by Lisa Grunwald and Stephen Adler. A collection of over 400 letters from famous figures and ordinary citizens chronicling our country's history. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Robert Gottlieb and Robert Kimball. They've edited a book collecting 1,000 of the finest song lyrics from 1900 to 1975. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.